This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Once in a Boo Moon is less than 2 weeks away and tickets are going fast. Don't miss this amazing event featuring live music performed by KBOO hosts from the Folk Strip, music from the True Vine, Swing and Country, and the Noontime Jamboree. The evening includes desserts, a silent auction, and everyone who attends will be placed into a drawing to win two tickets to the entire popular Wintergrass Festival in Bellevue, Washington. For information and tickets to Once in a Boo Moon, visit kboo.fm. And we are still seeking a graphic artist to donate artwork for our 45th anniversary, posters, t-shirts, and other marketing collateral. Please contact Lynn Fitch, Station Navigator, 503-231-8032 or navigator@kboo.org. Thank you.
Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me, it won't do no good to call the police. Always come late if they come at all.
I'm Lisa Swart. I spent 12 years in prison on a manslaughter charge. I shot my abuser to save my life and my children's lives after law enforcement failed to protect us. I'm just one of many women who are battered, then re-victimized by the judicial system. Hear my story on Prison Pipeline, February 18th at 6:30 p.m.
The time is 5:03, and this is KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Up next is the evening news. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Community College, celebrating Black History Month and welcoming journalist and civil rights activist Charlene Hunter Gault, February 28th at the Portland Art Museum. Ticket info at pc.edu.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on tonight's Evening News, Portland police shoot and kill a man at Portland Adventist Medical Center in Southeast Portland.
Oregon State Large Employer Labor Union calls to raise the salary of their lowest-paid workers to roughly $19,000 per year.
And an ad about climate change is pulled from Fox News following a cease and desist letter from ExxonMobil. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 18th, 2013. I'm Serena Fong.
And I'm John Rasmussen. Local officers were called into Adventist Medical in Southeast Portland at 9:30 yesterday evening in response to a report of an unknown man with a gun in its parking lot. Police cordoning off the area came into contact with the man and there was gunfire. Spokespeople for the Portland Police Bureau and the mayor's office have refused to provide further details about the shooting. It has marked the first officer-involved shooting of Mayor Charlie Hale's tenure. Although there is a mental health drop-in center on the hospital grounds, it is yet to be determined if the man was suffering a mental health episode. In December 2012, the city and federal government reached an agreement on reforms when a Justice Department investigation found that Portland police regularly use excessive force, particularly on the mentally ill. KBOO News will bring you more of the story as it develops.
The death of a man with Down syndrome who refused to leave a movie theater in Baltimore has been ruled a homicide. The incident occurred on January 12th after 26-year-old Robert Saylor refused to leave the movie theater after the film had finished. A spokesperson for the Frederick County Sheriff's Office announced the findings of the Maryland State Medical Examiner today and said that Saylor was forcibly removed by three deputies and suffered a medical episode while being escorted out. Saylor was found to have died from asphyxia. The three deputies involved have remained on duty since Saylor's death.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales is asking for a delay in issuing an annual report about the city's involvement in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. This would mark the second year in a row in which the findings in the report will be delayed. In 2012, Mayor Sam Adams pushed the report back 1 month. The agreement reached by City Council on their decision to join the JTTF called for a report detailing Portland Police Bureau government involvement in the federal partnership to be issued in January. The new report will not be issued until March. Mayor Hales moved the measure into City Council's consent agenda, meaning it will not be discussed but will receive a yes or no vote. Portland rejoined the JTTF on an as-needed basis in 2011 after withdrawing from the task force in 2005 over concerns about the broad and secretive powers that it holds. The move came after the high-profile case of Mohammed Mohammed, who in 2010 attempted to bomb a holiday gathering at Pioneer Courthouse Square with a fake weapon supplied to him by federal agents who set up the plot and resulting sting. After the 2012 report was unveiled, Amanda Fritz was the only commissioner to vote against it, stating the information provided was insufficient.
Governor John Kitzhaber's proposed budget increases funding for the child welfare program, and caseworkers who've been under a hiring freeze say the extra support is badly needed. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Angelique O'Rourke has the story.
More state requirements and fewer people to carry them out. That's how child welfare workers summarize what's been happening in Oregon. And they're in Salem today to make their case to lawmakers. For 2 years, they've been under a hiring freeze, like many state agencies, with two caseworkers doing the work of three. Add a challenging new software system, mandates to remedy racial inequalities in the foster care system and find more relatives to place children with, and Portland caseworker Barbara Casey says they've got their hands full.
All that, all good mandates, all good goals, preserving families, reunifying families, strengthening them, it's just compounded to get to it when you just don't have enough people there.
There are almost 1,300 caseworkers responding to more than 75,000 reports of child abuse and neglect, and supervising about 13,000 children in foster care. The governor's proposed budget for child welfare services would bring the agency to 80% of its staffing needs, up from the current level of 67%. Casey says one area affected by the staffing cuts is the amount of time at-risk parents can spend with their children. She explains that the visits have to be supervised, and there aren't enough workers, called social service assistants, to meet those needs. She says child welfare workers play an important role for Oregon families, and many resent being thought of as bureaucrats during budget debates.
We're not pushing papers. We are intervening at a very difficult time in people's lives, and to me it's a sacred trust. I have children and I have moms and dads that I want to reunite and keep at home.
The governor's new budget includes money for a new approach to dealing with suspected child abuse cases. It focuses on early intervention for families and keeping children out of foster care. The number of suspected child abuse cases in Oregon has risen for a decade, which could mean that more people are coming forward to report abuse and neglect. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, this is Angelique O'Rourke with KBOO News.
And now we hear the latest worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Newly elected Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren made her debut on the Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee last week and didn't waste any time getting down to business. The freshman senator had made a name for herself prior to being elected for her no-nonsense approach to challenging the concept of too big to fail banks. On Thursday, Warren had her first opportunity to ask questions of regulators for a number of organizations, including the FDIC, Security and Exchange Commission, the Treasury, and others. Warren's priority was clear. She wanted to know why financial institutions had never been on trial.
Every time there's a settlement and not a trial, it means that we didn't have those days and days and days of testimony about what those financial institutions had been up to. So the question I really want to ask is about how tough you are, about how much leverage you really have in these settlements. And what I'd like to know is, tell me a little bit about the last few times you've taken the biggest financial institutions on Wall Street all the way to a trial.
There was a long pause before Warren was offered an answer. The first answer came from Thomas Curry, head of the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency.
The institutions I supervise, national banks and federal thrifts, we've actually had a fair number of consent orders. We do not have to bring people to in a trial or...
Warren explained why she was concerned that it seems more difficult to bring financial institutions to trial than it is to bring the average consumer.
I just want to note on this. There are district attorneys and U.S. attorneys who are out there every day squeezing ordinary citizens on sometimes very thin grounds and taking them to trial in order to make an example, as they put it. I'm really concerned that too big to fail has become too big for trial. That just seems wrong to me.
Federal workers will need to wait at least 9 more months before seeing a pay raise. A Republican majority in the House voted in favor of extending what had already been a 2-year pay raise for 9 more months. With a vote in the House of 261 to 154, President Barack Obama's executive order to provide federal workers with a 0.5% pay raise was blocked. The previous pay freeze had already saved the country more than $103 billion over 10 years on the backs of federal workers.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio, discussions on working class issues at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Tonight's show looks into the incarceration of battered women. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be partly cloudy, with skies clearing later in the day, highs near 49 degrees. Clouds should continue into the evening, lows around 35.
It's 5:15, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In the wealthiest nation on earth, President Obama declared in his State of the Union speech, no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty. Right. Not only does his call to raise America's minimum wage put some real pop in populism, but it could finally start putting some ethics back in our country's much-celebrated but rarely honored work ethic. Kudos to Obama for putting good economics and good morals together, and for putting this long-overdue increase on the front burner. But then came the number, $9 an hour. Excuse me, Mr. President, but that means a person who works full-time would nonetheless, quote, have to live in poverty. Yes, $9 is $1.75 better than the current pay, but it's still a poverty wage, and it doesn't even elevate the buying power of our wage floor back to where it was in 1968. This is not merely about extending a badly needed helping hand to people struggling to work their way out of poverty. but about them giving a jolt of new energy to our economy, which it desperately needs. Ironically, while super-rich corporations are hoarding trillions of dollars in offshore accounts, refusing to invest in America, minimum wage workers invest every extra dollar they get in America, spending it right where they live on clothing, food, health care, and other needs. A 2011 Federal Reserve study found that a $1 hike in the minimum wage produces an additional $2,800 a year in spending by each of those households. So this is no time to shortchange these workers. This is Jim Hightower saying, yes, I know that congressional Republicans and corporate lobbyists oppose even a $9 wage. But a poll last June found that 7 out of 10 Americans, including a majority of Republicans, support raising the wage above $10 an hour. This is a time, Mr. President, to think big and take it to the grassroots.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Last week, a satirical television ad about climate change lampooning the multinational oil and gas corporation ExxonMobil was scheduled to air on Fox News during their State of the Union coverage. But a few hours before President Obama was set to speak, ExxonMobil sent a cease and desist letter to Comcast, and the cable provider pulled the ad. The piece was produced by three progressive advocacy groups, Oil Change International, The Other 98%, and Environmental Action, who collectively run the ongoing campaign, Exxon Hates Your Children. The groups created the satirical ad to raise awareness of the more than $10 billion the U.S. government spends annually in fossil fuel subsidies. The ad begins with a middle-aged white man wearing a suit speaking directly to the camera.
Here at Exxon, we hate your children. We all know the climate crisis will rip their world apart, but we don't care because it's making us rich.
In the cease and desist letter, Exxon said they, quote, fully expect the spot in question to be pulled down immediately, calling the advertisement, quote, offensive and nonsensical. In response to their scheduled ad being pulled, John Sellers from the group The Other 98% asserted that they would continue their work, saying, quote, when the richest company on earth uses their power to silence the voices of average Americans, it's a very dark day for democracy. Exxon thinks they can take away our right to freedom of speech. They will only make us louder. Earlier this afternoon, I spoke with Bob Funk, a Robert E. Jones professor of law at Lewis and Clark Law School. What are the legal implications of a cease and desist letter? Why did Comcast have to pull the ad?
They didn't have to pull the ad. The cease and desist letter is just a letter. I mean, it's just a letter from Exxon to Comcast saying, we don't like the ad, we want you to pull it. And if you don't, we threaten to sue you.
So can anyone issue a cease and desist letter?
You betcha.
Oh.
In other words, it's not a legal document. There are things called cease and desist orders that are issued by courts and by administrative agencies that have legal effect, but that's not what's involved here. This was just a letter.
So my understanding is that essentially Exxon was claiming libel. What does count as libel?
A false or misleading statement that injures somebody's reputation.
How do public figures play into that?
Supreme Court held that the First Amendment protects vigorous speech, and so vigorous speech about public figures needs some breathing room. So that if you make a false or misleading statement about a public figure, that won't be subject to libel. The First Amendment will protect it unless when you make the false or misleading statement, you know it's false or misleading.
What about corporations? Like, is Exxon considered a public figure?
Probably.
So in the advertisement that was pulled and then later aired on MSNBC, they said, I believe the language was, ExxonMobil hates your kids. And the way it was presented was clearly intended as satire with serious underlying implications, but the way it was presented was satire. And irony and satire is, you know, rampant and pervasive in our media and advertising. So how does that factor into libel?
Well, if people who see or read something would clearly not think you were trying to tell the truth, that it was clearly satire, then the rules of libel, I mean, it would have to be that they'd actually believe it.
In this particular instance, is the assumption that the general person would not think that Exxon literally hates their kids?
Right. I mean, I think that's a fair statement. I mean, obviously, Exxon can now sue MSNBC, any number of people for, you know, people who made the ad. Whether they will or not is another question. Probably they will make the right decision, which is no, they won't, because it would just give it more coverage in the media, and they're probably not going to win in the end anyway. The cease and desist letter had its effect. They did exactly what they wanted to do, which was to scare Comcast off. Letters demanding people to retract or demanding that people not do something are not that uncommon. It happens regularly, and sometimes people pull and sometimes they don't. Life goes on.
That was Bob Funk, a law professor at Lewis and Clark Law School, who I spoke with earlier this afternoon. The website Exxon Hates Your Children currently has around 23,000 likes on Facebook, and the television ad has over 230,000 views on YouTube. Earlier today, tens of thousands of environmental activists converged on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. to encourage President Obama to keep his commitment to act on climate change and oppose the Keystone XL pipeline. Free Speech Radio News will cover that story later this evening.
In 2012, Facebook reported a $1.1 billion profit margin, though it's likely to pay no federal or state taxes and even receive a tax refund of more than $420 million, according to a statement issued by Citizens for Tax Justice. The revelation sparked outrage on the web, as the social media giant was said to have received a $1.3 billion tax break on executive stock it issued to employees last year. It was the company's first annual financial report with the Securities and Exchange Commission since making its debut on the stock market last May. In related news, preliminary investigations into how Facebook's initial public offering was handled are said to call for the Nasdaq Stock Exchange to pay a $5 million fine, according to the SEC, plus an additional $62 million to compensate customers for losses stemming from the incident. If the penalty occurs, it would only be the second time SEC regulators have fined a stock exchange.
During a one-hour period this afternoon, the fast food retailer Burger King issued a string of strange and offensive tweets, laced with racial slurs, references to drugs, and the announcement that the corporation had been sold to McDonald's. The account had been hacked. The first tweet read, quote, "We just got sold to McDonald's. Look for McDonald's in a hood near you." The company's Twitter page also displayed an image of McDonald's Fish McBites, and their Twitter handle was changed to @McDonald's. Burger King alerted Twitter to suspend their account, and it was restored to normal a few hours later. Burger King has apologized for the fraudulent tweets. It has not yet been confirmed who is responsible, yet McDonald's denies it was behind the attack. Burger King currently has over 100,000 followers on Twitter, and this incident highlights the increasing concern over internet security in our modern technological age.
The United States has completed a $1.4 billion weapons purchase with the United Arab Emirates, a deal which will also include the purchase of U.S.-manufactured drones. The news came from the defense minister of the restrictive Persian Gulf nation. $200 million of the deal will go directly towards the purchase of Predator drones made by General Atomics Aeronautics Systems of San Diego, California. The UAE has said that the drones will not be fitted with missile systems, but will be used for reconnaissance purposes. The UAE and Saudi Arabia are considered important military partners of the U.S.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. For Monday, February 18, 2013. Israeli troops attack West Bank solidarity protests with political detainees, and naval forces attack fishermen off Gaza City shore. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Scores of Palestinian residents were injured on Monday when Israeli soldiers attacked a number of protests in southern West Bank organized in solidarity with political prisoners on hunger strike.
In Hebron City, 20 civilians were injured and many more were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation when Israeli soldiers attacked the protests at the city center with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. Residents said that Israeli troops attacked the protest from different directions. Local youth responded with hurling stones at invading troops. Israeli army units also attacked journalists covering the event and fired tear gas into nearby homes. Outside Hebron City at Al-Arub refugee camp, clashes erupted between local youth and the army when troops attacked a solidarity protest with political prisoners. Rami Jawabra, 15, was hit by a live round in his foot fired by Israeli soldiers, while many others were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation, medical sources reported. Also in southern West Bank, residents tried to block the settlers' road, known as Road 60, near Bethlehem City, in solidarity with political prisoners. Army forces attacked the peaceful protesters with tear gas, then forced them back by attacking them with rifle butts and batons. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation, local sources reported. There are four Palestinian political prisoners held by Israel on hunger strike. The longest is Samer al-Isawi from Jerusalem, who is on hunger strike since over 6 months. The prisoners are demanding Israel to stop its ill treatment to Palestinian political prisoners and freeze the policy of administrative detention. Israel uses this policy to hold Palestinians for unspecified time without any charges. In other news today, two Palestinian fishermen were injured and their boat damaged when they were attacked by Israeli naval forces off the Gaza city coast. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, based in Gaza, reported that the army gunboats attacked the Palestinian fishing boat while it's sailing 3 miles offshore, which is the area allowed for Palestinian fishing boats. Medical sources said that the two fishermen were moved to Gaza City Hospital for treatment after sustaining moderate wounds. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, February 18th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Ghassan Bamoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is John Rasmussen, Robin Ryan, Philip Morlier, Angelica O'Rourke, and Mike Klepfer. The producer is Serena Fong. Special thanks to reporters from Labor Radio. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg.
A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with.
The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis, 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Serena Funk.
And I'm John Rasmussen. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk radio show covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener comments, hosted by Abe and Joe Uris.
At 9 on Alternative Radio, listen to legendary MIT professor Noam Chomsky with host David Barsamian in a lecture titled The Threat of Democracy. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, local news and commentary with host Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein.
At 11 on stage and studio, host D. May Roberts presents a Black History Month documentary special titled Justice Denied. At 11:30 on Art Focused, host Eva Lake speaks with PNCA professor and student Mado Dieng and Devin Van Houten Maladano about a collaborative exhibit at the Linfield Gallery. Thank you, CABU members, for your support. We really appreciate it. If you are not a CABU member, you can become one by going to our website at kabu.fm and clicking on the tip jar.
And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, John.
Good night, Serena.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, February 18th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, pressure mounts on President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry to reject the Keystone XL pipeline after tens of thousands converge in Washington, D.C. As voters head to the polls in Armenia, many express concerns about poverty and unemployment. And residents in Tucson call for the release of two men stopped by police and taken into Border Patrol custody after a traffic stop. It's just one of other incidents under scrutiny after internal documents show that ICE used traffic stops to boost deportation numbers. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Protests across central Pakistan continued today following a weekend explosion at a vegetable market in Quetta that killed nearly 90 Shia Muslims. Rose Kitabchi reads for our reporter in Islamabad, Gabe Matthews.
89 people were killed Saturday, including women and children. 200 more were injured when 2 tons of explosives detonated in Quetta's Hazara town, a residential area home to the Hazara community who belong to the Shia sect of Islam. The relatives of the dead are refusing to bury them, instead sitting with their bodies in the streets. They're calling for Pakistan's army to take control of the city in Balochistan province and begin a targeted operation against the group who claims responsibility for the attack, Lashkar-e-Jhangvi. Solidarity protests continue today in cities like Lahore, Rawalpindi, and Islamabad, where businessman Niaz Ali was among the protesters.
Killing innocent Shia is inhumane, and no religion permits killing innocent people. The government should stop the killing and should punish the culprits.